just going to do it. I'm going to come in here and for 45 minutes play the bones. And I will punctuate my bone concerto concert with an occasional quick chorus of the Sheik of Araby and play the nose flute and crack my knuckles. Well, I mean, after all, you're interested in the sounds of mankind, aren't you? Are you only interested in the sounds of the mechanical contrivances that we create to preempt our own airtime and our own existence and our own life? Well, I suspect, though, it's a little combination of both. I don't know whether you saw this little news bit here, speaking of the ever march upward and onward by our own time here. The unfilled moat in front of the Land of Enchantment building at the World's Fair was the scene of a small rubbish fire yesterday. The moat is in front of the Simmons Mattress Company building on the Avenue of Invention. Painters have been working in and around the building, and the fire broke out among garbage in the moat and smoked out a whole crowd in the Land of Enchantment building. It was burning garbage floating into the Land of Enchantment building. Kind of says a lot about our world. I mean, it really, in a way, it was probably the best al fresco demonstration of the 20th century that they had out there at the fair. If you notice that Fiascoville is already beginning to settle in out there, out on Long Island, and Panicsville is beginning to be heard throughout the land. Well, I've known that feeling myself, Mr. Moses. Nobody can quite tell the public what kind of a feeling it is to produce and put together a gigantic $400,000 musical that is about to close in Toronto. This is a terrible feeling, and do a lot. You know, speaking of keeping the front up, we from time to time on this special service department here of WOR, we like to keep you abreast of what's going on out there in the unreported section of our world. You know, there's all kinds of people writing about what the world is. You know, official reporters, they write in newspapers and they come on the radio and they report. They appear on various television shows and make commentaries about the world. But hardly anybody who's out there living it discusses it or reports on it. And so tonight, in keeping with our new public service policy, we bring you another letter from one of the reporters, one of the people out there who's out there living it. And they're out there and this is High Schoolsville, USA. Dear Mr. Shepherd, what frightens me most about the great role reversal of male and female is that I have only lately grown sensitive to it. Often you talk, rarely I listen. Listening, however, provokes thought, and thought observation. Observation in any sphere, even my own, a relatively small one, the public high school. Here, a cross-section of what is to be in the most immediate future finds itself. And here, the GRR, the great role reversal, flowers. Not even latently. During the past few weeks, I have made a special effort to watch and listen more carefully to see if what you have said could be all true. At all true. It is. I uprooted some of my choicest manifestations of this social revolution in my own classes. I doubt strongly that you have ever visited a girl's locker room. Well, honey, I'm not exactly going to deny, but I did one time visit a girl's locker room. That's another story. We'll get into that later on when the program nears its end. But nevertheless, I doubt strongly that you've ever visited a girl's locker room, but I would sincerely like to smuggle you into ours to witness what I have found. Broad-backed, brassy-voiced specimens with lungs powerful as those of a moderately robust Brunhilde. Language powerfully spiced with four-letter words of the ripest vintage. Cigar butts. Yes? Since the great cancer panic, some girls have made the switch in more than one way. Allow me to coin the portmanteau word BIRL, B-I-R-L. It captures not only the respective sounds of boy and girl, but also suggests brawniness and bulk, as in burly. Fitting? The puns and anecdotes there are strong in the locker room, but some of the BIRLs are stronger and pride themselves on their muscular development. The most interesting specimen of all, however, I think, was the empty vodka bottle I found under my locker the other day. I say interesting because my school is not a problem school. The students, I am told, are about average, speaking academically, morally, and emotionally. Of course, there are exceptions. Equally intriguing is my health education teacher. She is a little sinewy lady, quite youthful, tweedy, close-cropped hair. She talks like Broderick Crawford. She can do 50 push-ups in 4 minutes. She has square fists, a square jaw, square shoulders. And what is most noteworthy, every day she barrels away in her compact car and drives my English teacher home. Now, for the English teacher, he is perhaps the modern male in those shirt advertisements. His hair is wavy and as long as Miss Heath's educations. Rather, hers is as short as his. Does not matter. In any event, he smells like lilacs. I know this because I sit in the front row and flutters his eyelashes. If this sounds grossly exaggerated, it is not. Picture his zircon pinky fingers twirling coyly as he reads Keats aloud in the general tempo and rhythm of humoresque. High school burls and teachers, yes, it is all there, but in the goys, may I call them that, as well. I will say very little on this point. The GRR trend is best displayed in the great subject revolution that has gripped our school of late. I elucidate, item below, one article from newspaper of said school. Let the conclusions be your own. Various new courses available for fall. Several new courses have been added to the curriculum this term. In addition, other courses have been announced for next term by the chairman of the various departments. Boys Food is the new course offered by the Boys Home Economics Department. It is designed for boys with an interest in knowing more about salad making and food in general and as a useful vocation. Boys who will complete the course will receive a certificate which they may use as a job preference. Human Relations is a co-ed course planned to give the teenager insight into his relationship with family, friends, and dating companions. Group discussions on all areas of interest to the adolescent are introduced to give teenagers an opportunity to discuss and express their feelings. Approximately one-third of the human relations classes will be made up this year of boys. Now, by way of note, electronic and woodworking shops have been now open to burls for a year now. Every day I face the Wagnerian burls in the locker room and the lady man in the gymnasium and the man-lady in the English room and the goys in the halls who compliment me on my lace stockings and inquire, "Where did I get them, honey?" Long pregnant pause. But I am used to this. I worry most when I find myself swaggering into the physics laboratory like a broad-beamed longshoreman. Signed, a Burl listener. Yeah. You think this guy'd ever make it at the bitter end? Come on, bring it out. There's a folk there. Hold it there. And you know, a lot of people think that that Philip Wiley wrote about this. I'm sorry. He did not. It's another department than what Wiley was discussing. You know, they've always talked about how mothers influence the children, especially the boys in a family. It's a big hang-up, you know, in the theater and all. And yet, nobody hardly ever talks about how the kids influence the mothers. Or the other way is right. I'll tell you, you know, it's a very funny thing about kids. I speak as an ex-kid here, who has barely peeled off the artichoke leaves from his soul at this point. However, someday, I hope, get down to the heart of it all. Wouldn't you love to get to the heart of your life, Ed, one day, sitting there in front of your TV set, watching the sociables playing around, and the guys drinking the Ballantines or whatever it is, you know, and those commercials. Have you seen any of those commercials in color? I'm going to tell you, any of you people who have never seen color television, and I don't sell color television, it is terrible to report that color TV commercials work. Have you noticed that, Ed? I went back here to our taping department here. We have a color monitor here at WOR. Of course, you see, we broadcast the Mets games, if you can call them games. We broadcast the Mets games in color, and it's startling. Really, it is amazing. I've seen a couple of television sets out on the outside, and they did not impress me. They all seemed vaguely pink and green. They didn't look like the world at all. I'll tell you what the color TV sets look like that I have ever seen when I've watched them in houses. They always look like one of those fountains, you know, that they bring out in front of places once in a while for a big display. The color fountain when the music is going and the water squirting up and it's yellow and green. It's arbitrary color. It's just yellow, green, purple, red. It just squirts all over. And it has very little to do with the actual people walking around. It's all different colors. Well, I don't know whether you've ever had the occasion to see a color monitor, which is to say, the way it's actually being picked up in the ballpark, it is startling. I'd much rather watch it on color TV than to go out there. I'll tell you, the colors are wild. It's beautiful. It really is. It's amazing color. And I was back there the other night watching the Mets play, it was Cincinnati, I believe. And it was the first broadcast from Shea Stadium at night, and the color was fantastic. The scary part of it is one of the cameras is directly behind home plate, and when that camera is on, you have a sensation that you better hide behind the desk because you're liable to get a foul tip right in the ear. You can smell the sweat, the ball players. It's so realistic that in a way, you know, you're a little bit too close. It gets a little scary. Well, I was watching the Mets play, and they came on with the commercial. It was the first color commercial I've ever seen, actually done with color in mind and all that. It was a beer commercial, and it came on, and it was fantastic. They were pouring that beer. Have you noticed that, Walt? Those beer commercials are wildly successful in color. It's very discouraging. Of course, I can only hope that as we get used to color TV and that will cease to be a factor again. But I doubt it because I suppose it will be. But they had this one commercial where these guys were making a salad. They had salad all over the place, you know, they're pouring the beer. And, you know, you're sitting there and after you've looked at the back of Frank Thomas's neck for about 5 minutes, and then they switch to that beer commercial, well, it's just an irresistible combination, you know? It is a very, very spooky that I think that the day will come when total selling will be possible. Already, you see, the World's Fair is proving that what life is about is selling. It's about buying and selling. And if you don't understand that, you're in trouble. In fact, a couple of nights ago, I turned on my radio and I was listening to a preacher somewhere way off in the Middle West someplace, somewhere down in the near South. And he was fading in and out, way down there in the low end of the dial. And his whole thesis about religion was that life is a game of buying and selling. Yes, he came on and he said, "Friends and fellow sinners, you are buyers and you are sellers. Some of us sell more than we buy. Some of us buy more than we sell. But let me tell you about the greatest salesman of all times. You know who I'm talking about, and you know what he was selling to you. He was selling to your life, and I want to..." Boy, I was sitting out there, you know, and I somehow realized why everybody somehow is vastly moved by Willie Loman. Speaking of Willie Loman, this is WORAM at FM New York. And speaking of peddling the goods there you go.
Valentine beer, Valentine beer, pretty
interesting.
Look, there, guys and gals, living it up.
Yeah.
Valentine beer, pounding syrup. Come on in, hot sun, cold beer.
Valentine beer, Valentine beer,
beach fun, Valentine.
Wow, you get a smile every time with a Valentine. Wow, what a beer that Valentine.
Look at that beer. Reach for a can. Right off the ice. Ooh, man.
Wow! Beer after beer, most refreshing around.
Won't fill you up. Won't let you down.
So get a smile every time with a Valentine. Get a smile every time. Make it Valentine beer. Wow, what a beer.
Hey, Walt. Now you're sitting in there at the control. That cacophony of sound, is that actually louder than me? You're riding the gain exactly right now, isn't that true? No. I mean, no. I want your personal statement that you don't turn up the commercial any louder than... Now, this is a thing that many people continually over the years have written me about. And they always say that the commercials are louder than the programs. And this is one of the great illusions, and I've seen it said time and time again. First of all, I think that things that are unpleasant often sound louder to you than things that aren't, you know. It's just a fact. But that I think, is being facetious. I do believe this, though, that the kind of sound that is used on most commercials is of a higher intensity than the program that is generally being listened to or watched. In other words, most commercials will make sure that what you call it. Now I could get into a technical discussion of it, huh? Oh yeah, oh I know about the expansiveness, the compression and all that. But what actually happens is when it's finally measured in the output. There's all kinds of arguments about this, and we can go on technically for half an hour and telling you about compression and high to low ratios and things of that kind. But I can tell you this, that technically, the commercial that is broadcast on a television station or a radio station, unless you've got an engineer who's asleep at the switch, and generally they're not, the commercial that rides out is maintained at the same level, line level, as the program is. That's the job of the audio gain engineer who's riding gain on me right now. However, commercials are made in a different way than programs are made. My voice here is a single tone. It really isn't, but my voice is a single kind of tone. I'm speaking to you here, but it's just my voice. However, have you noticed that rock and roll records often have the same high intensity? Because many a record that is made today is made specifically for radio. They don't make them anymore to be played on home record players. They make them to be heard out of the cacophony of some guy with the radio on, half turned on, in a garage someplace. They really do. So those records are made with the same kind of sound and intensity, let's say intensity of sound, as the commercials. Now, that's a funny thing about that. How to get into that and go into a long technical description of it would take up the next five programs. We could discuss all kinds of audio theories, one thing another. But suffice it to say that the gain is the same here at the radio station when they are played. Now, I can give you a little idea of how that is. If a guy is playing a flute somewhere. Let's just take a flute. If a man is playing a flute and you hear a flute being played, and let's say you had some way of measuring the volume of the flute. The volume of that flute, we'll say, is constant. We'll say it's at one. Now, if somebody were to get a violin, a flute, he gets a bass fiddle, he gets a clarinet, and a pair of cymbals, and he plays it all at the same time, and it is still maintained at level one, somehow the second thing would sound vastly louder than the first. True, Walt? Now, that's known, that is a phenomenon known as intensity, that is opposed to, now we're using very lay terms here, as opposed to amplitude volume. So, and you could even be closer to the flute, and the flute will not sound as loud as the combination of those instruments all playing one against the other. Now, one of the reasons, of course, is that the ratio between highs and lows and harmonics and subharmonics that are produce a different kind of sound, a sound that is more piercing and cutting, but not necessarily louder. That confuses people. Not necessarily louder. Now, this is a funny bit. You know, speaking of loud, piercing sounds, sounds can be loud and piercing that are not loud and piercing at all. And I remember one time, I'm a kid, see, and speaking of children affecting their mothers, I'm a great reader of the comics. You know, I'm a kid, I'm reading the comics all the time. And there was a guy, I'll give you the brass figlegee if you can tell me who it was that was, rah, crap, 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 bark, bark, crap, crap. Yes, indeed. Bork. All right, who always said that? Who used that kind of phraseology? Bork, bork. Yes, indeed. Yes. Who was that? You mean you don't know? What is it? This is a famous comic strip character. And he had a famous way of talking. He was a famous windbag. And he would preface everything with...
Cap, yes, of course. In my considered opinion, Cap, yes, Fork.
I'm reading the comics, and along about, I would say, about my ninth year, that is probably one of the most irritating years in the growth scale of mankind. That is right. I am about 9 years old, and I am seeing this comic. It was a single-panel strip, and I'm seeing it every day, and I really got hung up on this one for some reason or other. And so I took to talking like this character whenever I talked to my mother. And so my mother would say, Jeannie, will you go to the store? I'd go,
Cap. Yes, indeed, yes, rump.
And, after a while, at first she laughed. She'd think it's funny. Well, I went at least for about a year without ever answering her straight, that insane nuttiness. So she'd say, are you asleep in there?
Yes, cap, fork.
And she's starting to go up the wall, and it became a hang-up with me. It was like a reciprocal relationship, sort of. Whenever she'd say, will you come in? I'd go,
yes, indeed.
I could still do it. It was a very depressing thing. Now, how would you like it? You finally, you get to the point where you want to say, will you just once talk to me straight, Emil, once? Shut it up, will you? Well, there was a guy, I remember a guy who worked in an office with me one time, who used to have the world's phoniest Italian accent. He loved to pretend he had an Italian accent all the time. And he would say, let's go to the water cooler. Yes, and after a while it began to bore into my head. I was a kid, I was at the steel mill. And this guy would say that every 5 minutes, he would say, you were over there by the water cooler. And he was, of course, about as Italian as I am. He just prided himself on his Italian accent, and it became his one thing that he thought was funny. Almost everybody I know has one thing he thinks is funny. And he continues to do this throughout his whole life. Like my grandpa Charlie, Walt, the one thing that he thought was, well, he actually had two things that he thought was funny. The one thing he would do, he would go, he would crow like a rooster. That was his big funny bit. And then after the gigantic wave of insane laughter had subsided about that one, he would sit there for a second and you'd hear clicking. He'd, and he would push his false teeth out with his tongue. And the false teeth would stick out and he'd go clink, 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 and then he'd swallow them again. And he'd go, well, okay, so you laugh. Well, after about 10 years of that, I can only say that we would all come in and it would be like an automatic reaction. We would all sit down there, we'd come in, we'd sit on the horsehair chairs. They had these green mohair type chairs, that stick you all over the place. And we'd sit down, he'd go, click, 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 and all of us would pretend he's not doing it. And then someone would go, ha, 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 ha. Now, what were you saying, Grandma? Hey, go back to this. And it never occurred to him. Well, this kind of, I suppose, what it is, I don't know, is it folk humor? What kind of humor is it? I don't know. It's a kind of funny thing. I know a guy who, whenever he wants to draw a big laugh, in the middle of a lull of a conversation, he will reach out and grab the index finger on his left hand and go... He'd pop his fingers twice and then look around to see who's going to break up over this fantastic thing he's done. Big deal. Well, I got hung on that kind of thing. I'm about nine, see, and I'm doing Major Hoople. That's his name. Actually, Major Hoople in our neighborhood was not called Major Hoople, but Judge Puffle. It was called Judge Puffle in my neighborhood. Was it done by the same guy? I guess so. Well, we dug Judge Puffle. And somehow I kind of like Judge Puffle, the name Judge Puffle, better than Major Hoople. he always was wearing a fez, which I kind of thought had a nice sense of style to it. And he'd always be standing there looking out of the window and...
yes, indeed. Hork, hork.
And he had all these various little forensic tricks.
And he would say, I recall a time when I was leading a brigade in the Crimea. I said to General Allenby, hark back, crap.
And somebody in the background said, oh, that old windbag, listen to that again. And I got to doing that, and I got to inventing all this stuff. I'm telling you an actual fact. And my mother got so, for one solid year, she did not get a straight answer from me. And I would never did it to anybody else. My kid brother, it would bounce off of his head like, you know, like BBs off a tin roof, nothing. He would never notice it at all. And so it never worked. Somehow I must have gotten the idea that it was actually getting under my mother's skin. She would say this, now look, will you stop that? Will you stop talking like that? Ah, crap, bark. Okay, I'll take it under consideration. I'll submit it. Ah, hork back. She's got this funny thing, and turn back and look out of the window and peer out across that long yard. And this went on for about a year, and then just as abruptly as it had started, it disappeared. Now, once in a great while, when I talk to my mother on the phone, she'll say, how are you? And I go, hork back, rump. I'm glad you asked that, brack hork. And then she gets this tired sound in her voice. She says, oh, yes, all right. Okay. because these things never really quite go away from you. They never quite escape. Now, I know guys who have made a little bit like that into a total act. They have gone on the stage and have become gigantic heroes, cultural heroes in America, because of some little gambit like that. I suppose you know that one famous act now today started out merely because he was sort of a half-baked writer of gags, and he started out because he would imitate, he had a sort of a pseudo-Spanish accent, and he would entertain in the parlor with a pseudo-Spanish, like, mañana, you know, that kind of thing, and before long, he is on the network, and now he's got his own show doing the same thing now for dough, and it's still as equally unfunny as it always was. It has not progressed. It's too bad that I didn't work on my Major Hoople act. I don't think anyone has really played Major Hoople, except a couple of guys are doing it seriously. I can think of about five newscasters that are Major Hoople, you know. Americans, the taxpayer, once again, that Operation Rathole. You know, they go on. It's Major Hoople all over again. This character has never yet been recognized. It is a true American character. Somehow the Britishers recognize their national characters quicker than we recognize ours. And the Britishers, years ago, designated Colonel Blimp as their big windbag. And to me, Major Hoople is the American version of the same thing. And they're everywhere. They're everywhere. They're the profound, cliché-ridden nincompoops. Generally, these guys rise to high position. They often do. You see, we like to pretend when you read Major Hoople or Judge Puffle that he never made it. But after all, he was Major Hoople. He was Judge Puffle, obviously. Somewhere along the line, he was sitting on a bench. And went on. Now, the implication always is, when you read the strip, that he was a phony and never was judge or major. But I question that. I remember one time, unbelievable guy that I did know who was a major. I remember a major who was a little round, tight man. The kind of guy who thinks he's at least two sizes smaller than he really is. And he bought his uniforms 4 years ago when he really was two sizes smaller than he is now. And I can remember this guy standing on a platform in a camp that I was in once. And he used to love to give speeches to the organization that I was involved in at the time about morale. And he would also give little moral speeches about what the guy should do in town on the weekend. And this guy, you know, this guy looked like a little cantaloupe with feet. And he would stand up there he'd tilt his head back, and he had everything on him was shiny. He had the shiniest buttons, everything shined, his eyes would shine, his teeth would shine. And this was a true Major Hoople. He had a kind of a delivery that sounded a little bit like something like this. And he would get out there. He didn't actually go hork bark crap. He had a men
Today, most of you men are going to go on pass, maybe for the first time in this area, and might not know that there are a lot of things going on in this. And, of course, he's up there, and all he's doing is talking. It's just coming out of him, and he loved the feeling of having a large group of men standing out there sort of in his thrall. You know, you just, I don't know. You know, we never talk much about that one little aspect of success. Some people have a positive penchant and a positive desire to have guys standing in front of them, kneeling in front of them. It's a terrible desire. And I hardly ever hear this ever mentioned. I remember reading the other day in one of the newspapers, they had one of these perennial things that are constantly popping up in things like the Sunday Supplement, where various guys talk about how they got to be where they are and what they think about God and man and liberty and justice and all the rest of that stuff. And rarely do I ever hear a guy say, well, you see, the reason that I got to be a success was because I like to step on guys' heads. You know, I at the age of 9, I realized what fun it was to be the bully in the block. It's more fun to be the bully than to be the guy getting hit in the eye. Now, I recognized at the age of 10 that in every crowd, there's always one guy that says, all right, you guys, let's go. I discovered that, and I found that I enjoyed that. I really liked that. And this is never, ever discussed in any polite company. The drive to power is hardly ever, unless we happen to be talking about somebody we have officially designated as a bad guy. We officially designate, say, let's take somebody like Mussolini, you know, we already is a dictator, or take somebody like Hitler. Well, we officially designate him as a guy with insane lust for power. But we never point that out in other kinds of guys who may be not so obvious as far as being a dictator is concerned. Like say, the man who's the head of some gigantic, fantastic corporation, let's say General Motors. Somehow, we always assume that the way he got there was because he was so completely involved in selling cars, so completely involved in the business, that getting to the top did not occur to him. It just happened naturally because of his desire to make better cars, to sell better cars, to organize the company. This is, you know what I mean, Walt? No one ever says, well, you know, could it be that this guy's drive for power, that no matter what he would have been involved in, even had it been the mafia, he would have been the top dog because he just loves to be on top of guys. He just loves to yell and holler. Now, this is, in a sense, I suppose, Major Hoople or Judge Puffle. Judge Puffle, even though he was living in a rotten boarding house, a very crummy, flea-bag boarding house surrounded by a lot of just guys walking around, you know, he had to maintain at least the illusion of being the top guy in the crowd. I recall this character has rarely ever been discussed. Now, in American fiction, we know about Babbitt. We know about Willie Loman. But is Major Hoople sad or is he not? I don't know. It's very hard to tell. Is Colonel Blimp a sad character or is he not? It's very difficult. Maybe that's one of the reasons we don't discuss him. You know, speaking of Colonel Blimp and the rising, the great rising tide of noticing and pointing out and laying down on paper American characters. Today, the great American character is not a character at all. He's the writer himself. Very few writers ever any longer write about the world they observe. Hardly any of them ever write about anything but themselves. Arthur Miller writes about Arthur Miller. They do, of course. Salinger writes about Salinger in many different forms. We can go on. And then Mailer, of course, has given up all pretense of writing novels, and he now writes things called advertisements for myself, about me. This is the way I am. This is me here. Now, they don't write about themselves in the old sense that, say, Rousseau wrote about himself, or Proust wrote about himself. Not at all. They write about themselves as they wish themselves to be, rather than as they are. And that's the big difference between, say, a Mailer and a Proust, or a Miller and a Proust. A big difference.
And so a man has a great ideal about himself, either as a tragic hero or as a tragic bum, one or the other. You know, both of them are silly. And so he writes himself as that, and by George, he's going to prove it. Even if he has to wind up in jail 7 days, running out of nine, he will do it. And so you find the big difference between the man who writes. Of course, that's the thing. I'm going to get nine letters from people who say, "Well, all writers have always written about them." No, not the same way. Not at all in the same way. That if a man like Proust were writing about Proust, or Joyce, for example, Joyce were writing about Joyce, Joyce wrote quite truthfully about Joyce. His Joyce did not come off as a loving, beautiful hero. Not at all. He did not in any sense of the word recommend his young artist as the guy you would like to most spend the next 5 years with at the next desk next to. And yet, on the other hand, we have gone full service. This is the age of the ego, anyway. The age of the ego, when I say, I'm surprised we don't have a hall out at the fair, the Hall of the Creative Ego. I think this would have been far more indicative of our, you know, our world. It would have been a more popular thing than, say, the Hall of Dynamic Maturity. Nobody wants to be mature today. If you ever call some guy mature, he's liable to hit you in the eye. That's the world's worst thing you could say about a guy. That's a terrible thing. If you say to a guy today, you know, Charlie, there's something about you, there's something adolescent about you, he'll glow. If he's 68, he'll glow. He'll just, that's a wonderful thing to say to him, you know. Yeah, it's quite the reverse, of course. If you say, Charlie, you're a case of arrested development, then that's another story. But if you word it right, he'll love it. He will. So the age of dynamic maturity, I don't think it makes much sense. I don't think many people want to be mature. And, of course, dynamic maturity is an interesting contradiction in terms anyway. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know. Unfortunately, today we use the word mature to describe age, old age. That's not exactly what the word means. I suggest you look it up. It doesn't quite mean that. However, the age of the dynamic ego is perhaps a more fitting description of what most writers are doing. And so the character, the creation of a major hoople could not be. The average guy could not write, except, you know what he would do? I'll tell you how the average writer would write about Major Hoople. He would write about him the way Joseph Heller writes about Minderbinder, you see. It would be just a little incident that happens to the beautiful hero. The beautiful hero runs into Major Hoople, which is not quite the same thing as writing about Major Hoople. If you'll notice, example of the change that's come about, let's take a look at a guy like Sinclair Lewis. When Lewis wrote about his major, his Minderbinder, Milo Minderbinder, his was called George Follansbee Babbitt. And the book was about Babbitt, how Babbitt got to be Babbitt. The sadness in Babbitt and the strange desires and urges that Babbitt had. But none of the books today refer to any of the other characters other than just little tiny clattering cliches, a little moment there. We may get Major Hoople for a second in Catch-22, but no one knows why he got to be that way or if he even is that way. He is only that way seen through the eyes of the hero. And yet we have to assume that the hero is always right, that everything that he tells you about those people around him is clearly observed. That's questionable. And so, of course, there's no question about it, but that every writer today writes himself as the central figure. I'm convinced, and I know he would deny it, Heller is Yossarian. At least he wants to believe this. In many ways, I'm sure that Salinger sees himself as Seymour Glass. I doubt very much whether Sinclair Lewis saw himself as, say, Aerosmith, or saw himself as, say, Babbitt. I suppose the beginning of that came with Hemingway, where I'm sure that Hemingway continually saw himself, let's say, as the hero in For Whom the Bell Tolls, although he himself claimed that this was a man that he had run into in Spain. But I'm not so sure that he didn't invent that man he ran into in Spain. Maybe it was named Ernest Hemingway. And so Hemingway then, as most writers will today, I think his writing, I believe, is becoming obsolete in our time. I think most writers like Hemingway will follow. They will follow the course of Hemingway, and they will stop writing, and they will begin to live the writer role. So Hemingway, in his latter years, was the writer. He was the man who lived. He was a living hero. This is true, I'm sure, in many ways of Mailer. He's living the hero, the legend. So is Salinger. Salinger hardly writes. You don't read much by Salinger. He's the non-existent. He's the Henry Cabot Lodge of the living heroes. He doesn't come down. He doesn't show. And for that reason, he becomes even more interesting and more fascinating. He doesn't come among us and appear on the David Susskind show. So thereby, the mystique grows bigger and bigger. So whether or not we will ever see the delineation of a true Major Hoople as a character, about the closest man who came to that, I suspect, dealing with Major Hooples, was George Ade. He recognized the type. And George Ade wrote about the type many times, Major Hoople. But he didn't write about them in the extended form that he deserved. The birth, the flowering, the ripening, and the maturing of Major Hoople would make a very fascinating novel. And Major Hoople's progeny. The Major Hoople of today perhaps is Norman Mailer. Because Major Hoople, of course, goes back to the 19th century. The real Major Hoople is Judge Puffel. I think that perhaps Salinger and Mailer and these guys are the Major Hooples of our time. I suspect, however, the most dynamic of all the Major Hooples is Susskind himself. Susskind even uses some of the...
Mr. Preminger, Mork, and he drinks a little water.
Hoople was always quaffing a beverage before he would speak. He would say, my throat needs a little libation, quaff, quaff, and then he would go on. So perhaps Susskind is Major Hoople. He is now being seen on the little screens all over the nation.